The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
It is my pleasure this evening to welcome Reza Aslan, who will introduce Fareed Zakaria. Reza is an internationally acclaimed writer and scholar of religions. He is the Middle East commentator for NPR's Marketplace and Muslim Affairs analyst for CBS News. He is one of the most eloquent spokesmen for progressive Islam in America. Reza has written for many publications, including the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, Slate, The Nation, and many others. He has appeared on Meet the Press, Hardball, The Daily Show, Nightline, along with other television news programs. Reza was born in Iran and then raised and educated in the United States. His first book, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, has been translated into a half a dozen languages and was nominated for a Penn USA Award in Research Nonfiction. He is currently a research associate at the University of Southern California's Center on Public Diplomacy. His next book, How to Win a Cosmic War, Why We're Losing the War on Terror, will be published in spring 2009. Join me in welcoming our very special guests, Fareed Zakaria and Reza Aslan, to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here, and welcome to the downtown Los Angeles Library. As you know, our guest this evening is Fareed Zakaria. You all know who he is. He, of course, is the editor of Newsweek International, and he has a wonderful regular column read by many, many people for the domestic edition. Fareed was also the host of a great show that I actually miss nowadays. It's a Foreign Exchange on PBS. And, of course, he was also a regular member of the political roundtable on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Fareed's first book was The Future of Freedom, a best-selling book about a liberal democracy at home and abroad. And this evening we are going to talk about his just recently published book, also a wonderful book, called The Post-American World. I just want to also emphasize one very important thing that I just found out quite recently. CNN has finally decided to give Fareed his own show, since he shows up on TV so often. They just decided they might as well start paying him for it. It's a show, it's probably called Fareed Zakaria, as far as we know right now. But it starts June 1st. It's Sunday nights, and it's a show about the international affairs, which I think is wonderful and kind of surprising. After all, it would be kind of interesting to actually see a show on CNN about news. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Fareed Zakaria.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
It's great to see you. So, you know, I want to begin, if you don't mind, by just talking about what I think is a fairly provocative title for this book, The Post-American World. Tell us exactly what you mean by that.
You know, it came to me actually in a taxi in Singapore. I was in a taxi and going around, and the driver shows me a Ferris wheel, and I looked at it and admiringly said, but I guess perhaps somewhat patronizingly, said, "Oh, it's very nice. You have a Ferris wheel here." And he turned back and he said to me, "Sir, that's the largest Ferris wheel in the world." And then I was in a mall a couple months later in China, the South China Mall in Beijing, if you've ever been, and it's acres and acres of it. And I'm looking around, and The guy turns to me and says, as you can imagine very proudly, this is the largest mall in the world. By now, I've learned my lesson, so I don't say anything. But I think to myself, no, that's not true. The Mall of the Americas in Minneapolis is the largest mall in the world. We've been there. There's a sign under it that says that. Well, I guess in the last 3 years, a lot has changed since I had been to the Mall of the Americas in Minneapolis. I went back to my hotel room, did the kind of exhaustive research that we journalists do. I Googled around a bit and found that, in fact, while the Mall of the Americas had been the largest mall in the world, it didn't any longer make the top 10. I can go on. The tallest building in the world, the largest publicly traded corporation in the world, the largest English language newspaper in the world is in India now, not USA Today. And it just occurred to me that, you know, something very interesting was happening. The future was being shaped in many different places. The United States was still a very important big country, but all of a sudden the natives were moving up. And that you could see this activity, economic, political, and I wanted to convey the sense in which the center of the world was no longer just in one place. That in that sense, we had moved to a post-American world, one being shaped in many places and by many people.
So that's it for us then. We had a good run.
Well, if by power we mean we wanted to be the sole dominating power economically, politically, militarily, in the manner that only Rome had been 2,000 years ago. Yes, I think that's it for us. But I think that in this new post-American world, the United States remains the most powerful single country in the world. It is still incredibly important. But I think that ability to define the international system that we have had for 20 or 30 years, that is passing. That is passing, and I think the only way we will be able to affect things in the future will be in coordination with other countries. Even look at, you know, a specific problem like North Korea now. We have come to realize, with the Bush administration's case belatedly and kicking and screaming, but they have come to realize you can't do it without China. You can't do it without Russia. It's not a question of just getting their votes in the UN. It's that they have to talk to the North Koreans because they have leverage with them and we don't. And realizing that, you know, moving events on the ground involves this kind of coordinated response is a very different world from the world, I think, that, you know, we think of when we think of American diplomacy and leadership, where the United States kind of dictates and the rest of the world listens eagerly.
Well, then what do we mean? Because I do hear this from a lot of people who talk about the same kinds of things that you do, that regardless, America is still the most powerful nation in the world. Where that could only mean one thing, militarily. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, certainly militarily. I mean, we still have a military budget that is larger than the rest of the world put together. So we do about 55% of global defense spending is done in the United States. We still have about 25% of global economic product. We still have, if you look at the largest companies in the world, the majority of them are in the United States. So from a whole bunch of reasons, if you were to say you had to pick one country, that, you know, which one was the one that was dominant or was the largest, you'd say it was the United States. But it's not the dominant one because there are many other players. And there are many players of fairly significant size. You know, give you an example on issues like economics. The European Union now has an equally large market as the United States. They, on trade issues, they speak with one voice. So when we go into trade negotiations, unlike in the 60s, 70s, 80s, where the U.S. really could simply dictate whatever it wanted, the Europeans now have an enormous power because they are actually about as big as we are. You know, in trade, what matters is your market. How large is your market? How many concessions will people make to get into that market? Well, the Europeans can in some ways command about the same attention we can. So it's a kind of mixed pattern, but we're still plenty strong.
I mean, I agree with you. I think that this still scares the pants off some people. Not too long ago, Zalmay Khalilzad was in Los Angeles, I think speaking for the Pacific Council, and I had a chance to talk to him. Of course, Zalmay is now the ambassador to the United Nations, former ambassador to Afghanistan, former ambassador to Iraq. And when he talked about America's purpose in this new globalized world. He said very clearly it was to avoid multipolarity. Now, that seems to me a sort of a dangerous idea, because again, by all the facts that you lay out in the book and here this evening, when we say that we want to avoid multipolarity, the only unipolarity that we could actually maintain anymore is military unipolarity.
Well, also, I think you're exactly right. Look, we face a very important strategic choice going forward over the next 5, 10, 15 years. This world is emerging, the world I'm describing. You can see it in 100 different ways. You can look at the economic data, the political facts. The question we have to decide is, what is our strategic orientation toward it? Do we want to deny it, block it, in some way try to contain it, or do we want to embrace it? And we want to say the phenomenon I call the rise of the rest is actually a good thing. And is there a way in which we can remain central in this world because we are embracing it, we are celebrating it, and in point of fact, there will be a central role for the United States, but in a world in which there are other important players. If we take on the attitude that our efforts should be directed at preventing multipolarity, first of all, you can't prevent China from growing at 3 times the pace of the United States. That is an actual fact. You know, we grow roughly 3% a year. They grow at roughly 9% a year. That, over time, has a certain effect. You can't stop them from spending some of their money on non-military issues. You can't stop them from giving foreign aid. So I don't quite understand how we would go about doing it. But more importantly, I think it creates a very... It puts the United States in the position of trying to thwart the ambitions and the rise of these countries. We should be doing the opposite. We should be saying, we want you to rise. We welcome it. We want you to become stakeholders in the system. We want you to help us stabilize the system. So we're not the only guys out there worrying about who's going to be the market of last resort, who's going to be the creditor of last resort, who's going to be the central bank of last resort, and who's going to be the policeman of last resort. We welcome we want you in the tent so that you are stabilizing the world with us rather than outside it. And it really, I think, is going to be a very important strategic a fork that we face, and you can see the kind of various inclinations of people in terms of how they react to this world. You're right. A lot of people look at it with a lot of suspicion, denial. I mean, I've had so many people say to me, you know, this is defeatism. This is America bashing. And I say to them, you know, it's actually quite optimistic about American power, but you can't deny the fact that India, China, Brazil, and all these countries are growing. I mean, that's a fact on the ground. You can either choose to ignore it or not, but that's not, it's not defeatism to look at that fact as a fact.
Yeah, you write in the book, a world of synchronous global growth is good news. What happens, however, I mean, is this... In a sense, somewhat of a zero-sum game. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Obviously, as we're seeing the global growth and the rise of countries like China and India and the way in which the global poverty is beginning to be addressed in ways that we haven't seen before. At the same time, you know, you brought up China. One of the things that growth in China has been doing, you say 9% growth for every year for 30 years. China has 20 of the fastest growing cities in the world.
20
fastest growing cities of the world. And it's a bit insatiable with regard to natural resources. And so we're seeing China essentially take up the economic and political space in places like Africa, for instance, that used to be occupied by the United States, by the UK, by the French. Are we being pushed out in a sense? And what do we do about that?
Yeah, it's a very good question because it really gets at the two realms, I think, that exist. Look, in an economic sense, there's no question the rise of the rest is good news because it means more people in producing, consuming, investing, saving. 450 million people have escaped poverty in the last 20 years. That's more than in the previous 80. That is a thrilling prospect, first of all, just at the level of being human beings, to have these people able to live and to think and dream and invent and produce and consume. Secondly, it's great to have lots of other people doing well in the world. Think of our financial crisis recently. If we had not had pools of money in the Middle East, in Singapore, in China that could have come in, Citigroup would have gone bankrupt. Merrill Lynch would have gone bankrupt. Another 20 smaller banks would have gone bankrupt. We would have had a real run on the banks, and who knows with what psychological effects in the economy as a whole. The fact that there were all these places in the world that were doing well and could come in and stabilize the system has been enormously beneficial. Political influence, however, is not a win-win in quite that sense. You know, as China becomes more important in its region and in some others, as Brazil becomes more important in its region, as South Africa becomes more important in its region, and Nigeria, whose influence declines? The country that had untrammeled, unconstrained power and influence around the world. And that's the United States. Now, as I say, I don't think that this is, if you view this as something that we must jealously guard, we're going to be very reluctant. We're going to get into a tussle. If instead we view it and say, look, as with North Korea, it's a good thing. If we can get the Chinese and Russians on board, we'll have more partners in solving the North Korean problem. I continue to believe that America is not genetically an imperial country. It does not, the big difference is I grew up in India. There were memories people had in India of Britain and British soldiers and bureaucrats who loved the British Raj. They loved the idea of ruling India, and they had set up their whole estates and, you know, their whole life around that. You go to Iraq, those boys want nothing better than to get out. They want to get back to their track homes in Kansas. They want to get back to the malls in New Jersey. This is not something they want to do. And so I think it would be healthier for us as a country to have more partners.
What does that mean then with regard to these transnational associations and international associations that we've built up over the last century in order to maintain some sense of stability, whether economic or political, around the world? So, for instance, neither Japan nor Germany are members of the Security Council, which is ridiculous. China is not a member of the G8, which is absurd. Does it mean that either we make room for these growing powers, or we just simply make these kinds of international associations irrelevant?
Well, first of all, let's pick up on the first thing you said, which is, I think, so important, the institutions which we built. You know, we built all these institutions. When people trash them, it's very important to remember these are American creations. It's not as though the British and the French or Stalin wanted to create international institutions. It was all our idea, and the idea was we want to regularize international relations. We want to give it more of a rule-based system, a system that incorporates norms, that incorporates good behavior and things like that. And by the way, it's worked pretty well. Not perfectly, but if you look at the first 50 years of the 20th century and you look at the second 50 years of the 20th century, I'd take the second in terms of place to live in, right? The crucial question, as you say, is they have become outmoded and archaic in various ways. I tend to be a realist. Look, there is no way you're going to be able to reform the UN Security Council. You're trying to reform an organization, the reform of which would require that the currently powerful members reform themselves out of power. That kind of reform doesn't happen, right? So in order for it to happen, you have to get the British and the French to realize, well, you know, we can't have two European countries that have a veto. We need to have more countries that have a veto and therefore become as powerful as we are. It's not going to happen. So what's the realistic scenario? The realistic scenario, I think, is what I call in the book a la carte order. That is to say, you use whatever organization you can, and you try to use these organizations to create, to have a forum, to have some legitimacy, to create the effective possibility of multilateralism. For some things, you might need to use the G8. For some things, you might need to use the UN. For other things, you use the WHO, dealing with infectious diseases. There are some easy adjustments, I think, that can be made. You're absolutely right about the G8. I mean, it's insane that you don't have China and India, which are probably the fourth and seventh largest economies in the world, and soon to become probably the second and third largest economies in the world, in an organization that's meant to deal with the global economy. It's silly that we don't have more representation of countries like Brazil, China, and India in the World Bank and the IMF. You know, there's this tradition that the Europeans get to pick a European for the head of the IMF, and the Americans pick somebody, an American, for the World Bank. And in America and Europe, this is regarded as a kind of charming custom. You can imagine that the other 90% of the world does not regard this as particularly charming.
Well, here's why I bring this up is I think you're right. I think that the idea of reforming these organizations is going to be incredibly difficult, and maybe we do need to have this a la carte vision that you have, and maybe we need to start thinking about some alternative organizations. But what doesn't change is the problems of the present, which is that, again, picking on China for a little bit longer here, if you don't mind, is that you have this country that's, I mean, rising at an incredible rate, that it has this, as we said, insatiable appetite for natural resources, and is gobbling up basically whatever it can, and doing so without what we in the United States and the larger Western world would tend to consider the let's say moral guidance, if you will, that we would expect from these kinds of superpowers. And I'm referring here, obviously, to China's efforts in Sudan as just one of many examples. What do we do? How do we, as China continues to grow in influence and in power, and as we necessarily begin to recede from the global stage, what do we do about countries like China? How do we rein them in? How do we make sure that they are responsible members of the international community?
It's the crucial question. I think the big strategic question we face in a specific sense is how do we bring China into the global system? How do we find a way to make it feel really that it is a stakeholder in this system? Because if China doesn't feel that way, you know, that would be a very different world. It would be a world marked by great power tension. It would be a world that would resemble more the Cold War. It will probably mean in some way the leveling off of this kind of global growth and peace and prosperity, global prosperity, has hinged on great power cordiality, if you will, if maybe not cooperation, but at the very least the absence of great power competition. You reintroduce great power competition and think about the last 400 years before 1945, the 400 years preceding that in Europe. And, you know, it's not a pretty picture, and you don't want to run that experiment, it seems to me. So how do you do it? First, I think you do have to recognize that you can't have unrealistic expectations. You know, you say that China has an insatiable appetite, and it's true. But let's remember, we are 5% of the world's population. We consume 25% of the world's resources, okay? China is, whatever, it's about 20% of the world's population, and it still consumes much less oil, for example. The Chinese consume about 7 million barrels of oil a day. We consume 22 million barrels of oil a day. So, you know, we are still the gorilla of all global demand with regard to oil. They have dealings with some unsavory regimes in order to make sure that they can get their energy and raw materials. In the book, I point out that a Chinese diplomat says to me when I berated him about their involvement with Sudan, he said, you know, you're right. We have a relationship with a rather nasty regime because we are worried about our oil needs. And he says, and you support a medieval monarchy in Saudi Arabia that has funded Islamic terrorism for 30 years because of your oil needs. And how are they different? And I think, you know, with a little bit of humility about these things, you know, if we had those kinds of needs that they have, so how do we do it? I think the most important thing we have to do is to give them a feeling that their legitimate rise is something we welcome and we celebrate, but that we really want to deter the bad stuff. You know, it's a kind of mixture, it seems to me, of reassurance and deterrence. And that's one of the reasons I'm not one of these people who thinks the United States should hollow out its military. I think it's a good thing for the U.S. to have a very large military that, in effect, deters the Chinese. It says to the Chinese, you don't want to play this game. You know, if you want to get into a military competition with the United States, it will be very expensive. Mm. And you will really be making a decision about how what path you want to go down. So I'm in favor of, you know, a stick. But you also have to have a carrot to make these countries, particularly China, feel, you know, if we do adhere to the rules, we'll get to shape the rules as well. You know, we're not just going to be sitting there at the table, but we will be participating in the rulemaking.
You brought up oil, so I do need to. I mean, we are, after all, in Los Angeles. It took me an hour to drive the 13 miles from my house to this library. At the same time, of course, every day more and more Chinese enter the middle class and they start buying cars. And we're seeing oil now at $130 a barrel, which I have to say, 8 months ago, 10 months ago, would have been ridiculous, would have been a joke. And now we just sort of, you know, bat our eyes at it and move on. What's going on? I mean, what's happening? Is that it? Is that the days of cheap oil are over?
It's the rise of the rest. 124 countries last year grew at 4% a year. And what does growth mean? It means people get off bicycles and they get onto buses or they get into trains or they get into cars. And whichever they do, they're consuming energy. The huge problem we face is actually not just with oil. It's with every commodity in the world, the prices of which are skyrocketing. Because if you look at what's happening in food, people are eating more protein, God forbid. They're eating more carbohydrates. And this is, I'm talking about people who go from $2 a day to $5 a day. What's that $3? They're buying food. And those people, and that's what's affecting food prices. Now, there are other things involved as well, but the fundamental demand pull is just huge. This is going to be one of the great problems we face, how to manage the problems of what I call the upside, that is the problems of synchronous global growth. It's going to mean we're going to have to, in some ways, use stuff a lot more efficiently than we do. We use water, for example, incredibly inefficiently, I might point out, in California. But, you know, the average European uses, who's at the same standard of living as an American, uses half as much water Americans do. But it's going to be something that everyone is going to have to get better at. Look, and the reason we use it inefficiently is very simple. It's free. You know, everybody uses stuff that's free and efficiently. We're going to have to figure out what to do about food with regard to technology. The Europeans, for example, will have to get over their hang-ups about genetically modified food. You're not going to be able to feed a rising Africa if you don't use that. So, you know, there are specific issues, but your basic point, Reza, is exactly right. Welcome to the new world. Mm-hmm. This is a world. There was a wonderful column, Martin Wolf, the writer for the Financial Times, wrote. He said, you know, it used to be that there were two basic concepts in economics, capital and labor. He said, that's become irrelevant now. Kind of everybody's, you know, running the economy is okay. The two most important concepts for the economy going forward is energy and innovation. Are you a source of energy, oil, natural gas, coal, or are you a source of innovation? And that's going to decide whether or not you make it in this new world. If you're Saudi Arabia, you're going to be fine. Because every time, as India grows, as China grows, they need your oil. If you're Qatar, everybody needs your natural gas. If you're Iran, you've got both, and you know, you're in a sweet spot. But if you're not, you need to be the United States, you need to be Singapore, you need to be Denmark, you need to really be hustling in some way in the world of innovation.
Well, let's go back to the U.S. here for a minute, because I think this is an important point here. You know, our greatest export, of course, is precisely innovation. But you also write in the book that just, you know, in this moment in which the rest of the world is beginning to open up, we're doing the opposite. We're beginning to close down. There's a Pew poll that you cite that just blew my mind. It was a 07 Pew Global poll. And it apparently stated that with regard to population opinions, that the United States is dead last in its acceptance of free trade. Last.
Yeah. They just asked a simple question. They said, is open trade a good idea? And, you know, countries like China, India, 88%, 90% said yes. And this, you know, for anyone who's lived abroad will know this is stunning, because these countries used to regard free trade as a Western plot to rape their economies, to ruin their societies, to allow multinational corporations from the West to dominate them. And all these countries are basically saying, no, this is a great thing. This is what has allowed us to grow. The country that came 47th out of 47 was the United States. The lowest support for free trade in the world, and for the 47 countries poll. There was a second question they asked: do you think foreign companies are a good influence or a bad influence in your countries? And again, all these countries, Nigeria, Bangladesh, you know, saying yes, wonderful, you know, 70-80%. I mean, I was particularly struck by the Indian number, because the Indians, I always thought, have a legitimate reason to be suspicious of multinational corporations. They were colonized by a multinational corporation. You know, the British East India Company came in as a trading company. 250 years later, it's still ruling the bloody place. And so you could understand the suspicion. There, 77% of them say it's a good thing. We were fourth from the bottom again. So we want our companies to be treated wonderfully when they go abroad. But somebody wants to come here and buy an American company. Wait a minute, they're foreigners, you know. But we've got to remember, when we're abroad, we're foreigners too.
and worse now, of course. I was just reading that our H-1B visas, the visas that we give to people to come here and work, is now set so low. I think the number is 85,000. That, you know, the only way to come here is through lottery, which sounds kind of, you know, fun and exciting, but it's really ridiculous that essentially what we're saying is, we're not going to take you based on your abilities and your mind and what you can give to this country. We're just going to pick a number out of a hat. I started doing some research on this. 70 of the 300 Americans who have won a Nobel Prize were immigrants. The founders of Sun Microsystems, Google, and Intel, immigrants. And unfortunately, what's happening is, as we're closing our doors in the name of security or what have you, other countries, Canada, certainly throughout Europe, have begun to do the exact opposite. They've opened their doors. And this brain drain, I think, is going to have a very serious effect on the way that we become precisely the innovation exporters that you're referring to.
Look, Bill Gates has been amazingly energetic on this issue. He's gone to Congress and testified repeatedly on the need to expand the visa program for talented immigrants, for foreign students. But yet, you know, Microsoft, which obviously has a fiduciary responsibility to its shareholders and to itself, had to make a decision about what to do. It needed to open a new research center. It just couldn't get the visas it needed for the people who it wanted to hire. So it opened the research center in Vancouver. Mm. And I think that is, you know, if you want to look at what the future will look like, that is the great danger. And it's happening at a time, just as you say, that others are getting smart. The Europeans have created a new blue card. I wonder where they got that idea from. And the blue card is a permanent residency for talented immigrants that allows them to stay in Europe forever, and is being given out, you know, to attract talented people. Mike Bloomberg, I think, has the right idea. Bloomberg says that he would be standing at the end of the graduation line of every PhD program in the country, and he would hand a green card to every person who got a PhD who was a foreign student. Because, look, first of all, you need to understand, 50% of the people who get PhDs in science in this country are now foreigners. That's who does it. You know, it's arduous work. It's all that, all these labs, they're populated by foreign. The key question are they going to stay here, and is the innovation going to stay here, or are they going to go back, and will the innovation go back with them? And it just, to me, this seems like there are so many things our government is doing right now which are brain dead, but this seems to me particularly, I mean, it's on the scale of the magnitude. You would think to yourself, what about this do you not understand? You know, we're talking about probably 15,000 people. This is not a huge number. You know, and yet these are the crucial innovators who are going to found the next generation of Googles and Intels and Sun Microsystems. And yet, you know, right now what's happening is every year they go back home because they can't stay here, not that they don't want to.
Of course, this is a personal issue for the both of us. We're both immigrants.
No, and I got an H-1B. I came here as a student. I stayed. And if the current rules were in place now, I don't think I would have been able to say, because in my day, the H-1B, this is a technical point, but the visas basically filled the entire year's supply so that there were enough visas for the people applying. Obviously, there was a 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 chance you would get one because you had to be qualified, you had to follow all the paperwork. But there was, at the end of that road, an actual visa potentially for you. Today, the visas get filled the day they are announced. There's no chance you really get them unless you know you've in effect been pre-selected by a big corporation that's already identified you. It's a terrible system because it's not getting the adventurous, the enterprising, the dreamers, who tend to be a little bit more less corporate, less. You know, I'll give you one example of this, is because it's not just about work visas. I was reading the newspaper when I was in England a couple of months ago, about this British band that had wanted to come to America to do its, you know, go on a little tour. And it's a young British band of kind of some kind of music that I'm sure I would find completely cacophonous. But apparently there was this great tradition in Britain ever since the Beatles that you came to America to kind of, you know, strut your stuff, to try yourself, to make it. And they were explaining that it turns out you can't do that anymore because the visa's requirements have become so onerous, just for a visiting visa for 3 months, that you have to be a very established band. You know, the Rolling Stones can do it, but they can't. And so they were going to go to Eastern Europe instead to tour. And I thought this was such a sad metaphor, that we want these people to come here and think of this as the place where you innovate, where you try things new, you know, where you create the new kind of cacophonous rock music. But no, you know, and if we close the, you know, if we make it more and more difficult, the big change that I talk about in the book is there are other options. That's what's changed. Yeah. You know, if you make it so difficult for people from the Middle East to do business in New York, and if they have to go through these 4-hour security checks, they go to London. And London has become the world's leading financial center.
And worse than that, too, I think it changes America both literally, but also symbolically. I mean, I know that when I travel around, particularly the Middle East, and I talk to a lot of young, intelligent, enterprising graduates of very prestigious universities, it's not as though they say to themselves, I would like to come to America, but I can't. They just simply say, I don't want to come to America. I want to go someplace else.
There's a sense of humiliation, right? Who wants to be in that position where maybe today at Kennedy it'll be 3 minutes to get through, maybe it'll be 3 hours and I'll be strip searched. And, you know, there's a certain sense in which one story about a strip search turns into 1,000 stories. And, you know, there's always that tendency. And so you have to be very careful about how you ascend, what kind of signal you're sending out. Unfortunately, our bureaucratic system is such that now nobody wants to be the guy who lets in the next Muhammad Atta. And, you know, you'd much rather keep out 200,000 people because there's no cost to that for you bureaucratically. You know, who's going to say anything? But if you let in the next guy, you know, you'd lose your job. You knew it'd be a national embarrassment. And the reality is, you have to. We're always making a kind of judgment about risk and reward in these situations, and you're always taking a little bit of a risk. The only way to make sure you don't let in terrorists is to shut down the borders, right? The fact that you're taking anyone in means you're taking some kind of risk. So you're always drawing a line, and the question is, how do you draw it, and what signal do you send? And our system is not attentive to that right now. Look, for heaven's sakes, we're still on code orange. You know, I mean, do you guys realize we're living in the second highest threat level if you've been to an airport? What sense does that make? Well, there's no evidence, by the way. I've talked to the Director of Homeland Security. I've actually looked on their website to make sure. There's no evidence of anything. It's just who wants to be the bureaucrat who lowered the threat level, right? Because if something, again, there's no cost to keeping it high. It just means that we have to go through longer procedures in the airport. But, you know, if you lower it and somehow some backpack bomb went off in a, you know, in a mall in the Midwest, that would be a big deal. So better keep it high.
Honestly, I'd put up with any level of threat not to take my shoes off at the airport. This is, of course, really problematic because, as I think you say very elegantly in the end of the book, in this new global order, America does have a very important role to play. We're not going to be the largest economy. We'll still be the largest military, and there's good and bad parts about that. We're not going to have the kind of global influence that we had before. But we can, in a way, play, I think the term that you use is the honest broker, the referee between these various groups, as the country built on a set of principles that are universal and that can be essentially our number one export. In other words, our morals, our principles, our values can become our greatest exports.
And in a way, you know, that has been the promise of America from the founding. We were a small republic, you know, 13 colonies nestled east of the Allegheny Mountains. And it was still a sense that there was something special about this place. I think, by the way, we will still be the largest economy. You know, it would take a Herculean task for China to overtake the United States, and, you know, it would have to continue to grow at 10%. So, we'll have plenty of hard power as well, but you're absolutely right. The key is going to be if we can maintain or enhance, regain, use what word you will, the trust of the world. Because, you know, people talk about the rise of Asia. This, for somebody who grew up in India, this makes no sense. Asia is a Western concept. You know, there is no Asia. There is China, and there is India, and there is Japan, and they kind of don't like each other. And so when you talk about it, you know, there is a role for a country like the United States to play that honest broker's role, because we can have better relations with China, with India, with Japan than they actually have with each other. But the way you maintain that is by actually living up to your ideals, being reassuring, not or constantly threatening. And I think one part of it that I'm particularly amused about in today's climate is to recognize that we live in an increasingly democratic world. You can't just make the deal with the leader. You know, you have to, right. The population at large has to also be sympathetically inclined, has to think of you in a benign way, has to think of you. You know, it's an odd thing that for an administration for whom spreading democracy has been the most important thing, they desperately need either dictators as allies or Democrats who will flaunt public opinion, like Tony Blair. You know, but how many people are going to say, yes, I'm with America, even though 85% of my population thinks that this is a bad idea? It doesn't last that long. You know, it's a much more durable path to an alliance to try and woo the people of Britain as well as, you know, as just hoping that. So people will point out, well, now Sarkozy is in power. It's great. It'd be not even nicer if Sarkozy could give an openly pro-American speech in Parliament and be regarded well by, you know, 70% of the French public, which is not true today.
I want to open it up to the audience for some questions, but as we do that, just, you know, just a question for you. How are we doing on that? How are we doing on the whole setting the moral agenda?
I think that, look, we've gone through a bad patch, I guess is the best way one could put it. And I think, by the way, I'll tell you, I think that the things that have hurt us most have not been the fact that we have involved ourselves in international affairs, you know, whether it's the Iraq War, it's Afghanistan, which, by the way, was also quite unpopular in the Muslim world. I think those things, of course, have hurt, and I'm not diminishing them. I think, however, the things that have truly kind of almost had a more permanent stain are Abu Ghraib, and the cover-up of Abu Ghraib, that is to say, nobody being held accountable, Guantanamo, this absurd debate about torture, because that is a sense in which, you know, people have always known the United States is a great power, and great powers do things, and, you know, they mess around the world, and sometimes they make mistakes, and sometimes they do things you don't like. But the sense was always that the United States was, however, a great liberal democracy that operated on a high moral level. You know, Hubert Humphrey once is supposed to have said that the most important foreign policy act of the 1960s was the Civil Rights Act. And I think that there's some truth to that. The idea being that, you know, you sent a signal around the world that, you know, this is how we want, this is how we will try to live up to our own ideals. And when we don't live up to our own ideals and engage in kind of real hypocrisy, that I think kills us much more than if we, you know, go into Panama or Grenada or some or a country, you know, some foreign policy issue that people don't agree with.
If you have a question, please raise your hands, and there is a microphone that will come around. Please wait until you have the microphone. We are recording this for podcasts, and this is that moment when I have to say these words. A question is not a statement. It is a question. Yes, sir, here up in front.
As long as we have managed to terrify our entire population by having the towers in New York attacked, how do we ever open up our borders again to the kind of immigration policy you would like to see for all of the techies that can come here?
As long as we have the means or the fear?
I think it's the fear that's driving it. How do we get rid of that? How do we avoid that?
I think that is one of these cases where it really just will take leadership, because I think what we have to make people understand is that, you know, terrorism is an unusual phenomenon in that it is defined by the response of the onlooker. If you are not terrorized, it doesn't work. And it may sound kind of abstract, but think of the way the British dealt with the IRA for 20 or 30 years. You know, the key was that they were resilient and they bounced back and they showed the IRA that this is not going to work. And in many ways, other countries have done the same thing. What I worry about is, you know, I think Americans are actually very resilient. If there were to be these backpack bombings that people worry about, three at one, you know, simultaneous in different places, here's what I think would happen. The actual effect on the American economy and society would actually be very, very little. You know, it's a $13 trillion economy. Three malls going out of action for a couple of days will not do very much. Look at what happened with the London bombings. The stock market went up 12 hours later to its original levels. You know, people realize that actually after a while, these things are not actually that big. And big, modern Western economies are very large and very complex. But here's what would happen. Point two. Washington would go berserk. There would be mass hysteria. There would be a new Patriot Act. There would be new all that. And that's where you need the political leadership to say, look, this is not the answer. The answer is that we bounce back. We are resilient. We show these people that we don't cower in fear. We show them that we don't alter our constitutional framework and our balance of powers and our balance between rights and liberties. I hope we are past the worst in some ways, because I think some of this people are beginning to understand. Obviously, my big fear is, you know, look, if there are other attacks, and the attacks could happen, and they could be small scale, some of these nutcases could get lucky again, and then how will we react? Will we have the coolness of temperament to be able to respond in that way? That's the key. I think otherwise we're slowly moving to the right path.
Perhaps that lady in the second row.
All of the countries that you mentioned as rising rapidly are highly populous: China, India, Brazil. For the well-developed but mid-level countries, let's say, just to pull it out of my mind, Australia or Italy, places like that, not their leaders, but how would you guess that the average working class person in a place like Italy or Australia sees himself vis-a-vis the rise of China and India? Would a working class person in those countries see themselves as better off with there being more economic players in this world?
It's a very good question. The two countries happen to be quite different. Australia has gone through a 10-year phenomenal boom that has been fueled by Chinese demand, because Australia actually has lots of natural resources. And as a result, Australia has been growing at 5% a year, which for an advanced industrial economy is phenomenal. Italy is a more interesting question, and it is in some ways more representative of the industrial world. And, you know, if you want to know how Italy feels, in a sense, ask yourself how a combination of Massachusetts and Ohio feel. You know, in Massachusetts, there are a lot of workers who do high-end jobs, which are value-added, which in which, you know, they thrive in the global economy. In Ohio, they're in a lot of industries that are being left behind. And in Italy, you have the north of Italy that is doing, by and large, superbly. They're doing a lot of complicated manufacturing, a lot of luxury products, which are in greater and greater demand. If you've ever tried to buy a Prada bag and you get a, you know, you're given a number and told that, you know, mm-hmm. in 3 years you'll get that bag or something. But in the South, you have a problem. It's in some ways the great question for the industrialized world, which is that there's going to be this divide. Because the global economy is moving towards this knowledge orientation at the upper levels, where people with training and knowledge are being rewarded disproportionately, and people who use their you know, just brute labor it's becoming a commodity. And what do we do about it? How do we, in some way, bring everybody along? It obviously, you know, the words everyone has heard are education and retraining. I don't have any better words. I think that we probably need to approach it with a different kind of ambition than we have. If we are really going to try and bring everybody along, we need to think of retraining the way in which, you know, the Truman administration, the Eisenhower administration thought of college education with the GI Bill. And the idea that, you know, this has got to be a mass program. If we were to do retraining on the order of the GI Bill, you're talking, first of all, about a very expensive idea. But I think it's very important to do, because you want to bring the whole society along. You've got to train all these elements of the society, and you've got to figure out what works. Retraining actually works pretty well where it's been tried, but it's wrenching for the person and it's expensive. But I think it's a very valuable investment worth making for the future.
As a corollary to that question, and I'm thinking specifically of Italy in this particular case, you know, one of the points that you make in the book is that as these economic fortunes rise, so does nationalism. And I wonder how much of that has to do with economic growth, and how much of it is a reaction to globalization, a reaction to these transnational associations and the way in which borders and nationalities are beginning to very slowly give way.
It's probably a combination of the two. You know, what's happening is interesting is if you look at the economic globalization and the way in which it's changing things, and then you go to China. I talk in the book about this guy I met at an internet cafe, young Chinese yuppie. And he's, you know, you talk to him and he's completely fluent and conversant in American pop culture, and he knows all about American technology. And then you start talking to him about Tibet, Taiwan, Japan. And he is a hardcore nationalist and, you know, talks about using force. And all of a sudden you feel like you're in Germany in 1910. Mm-hmm. You know, even then it was the young, the professionals who were the most nationalistic. So why is that happening? Partly it's just growth and pride and a sense of coming, you know, coming into their own. But part of it is, I think you're right, it's the disorientation of a world in which there is increasingly a kind of borderlessness. What I notice, which is particularly interesting, is in some countries, what's happening is there is an even greater return of attachment to the oldest identities people
right.
have, you know, which go even beyond the nation state. And if you look at Scotland, the Scots have elected a Scottish Nationalist Party that wants to dissolve the Articles of Union with that created the United Kingdom, because they look around, they say, we can thrive in this globalized world, you know, and we'd be a part of the European Union. And their loyalties are, in a sense, to something much older than the United Kingdom. Or in Belgium, the Flemish and the French speakers, you know, there's a pull to a much older sense of identity. And it may be because a world in which, you know, so much is churning, you go back to very familiar and very deeply ingrained loyalties.
Of course, sometimes the consequences of that is those more primal identities happen to be ethnicity, religion, and those things sometimes cannot be controlled
by the state, and they begin to challenge the state in very dangerous ways.
Precisely. I mean, I think I'd be interested in your take on that particular issue with Iran, because Iran is, on the one hand, the oldest nation state in the world. Iran and Egypt are probably the two countries that have been in continuous existence in present form for thousands of years. But yet Iran has lots of non-Persians in it. And I wonder whether that this poll, you know, whether you're seeing fissiparous tendencies there.
You'll have to wait for my book. You're going to have to pay
spoken
for that
like
answer.
Spoken like a good answer.
Yes, sir, right here in the middle.
I didn't realize I was getting paid for this.
Thanks. America's only been a sole hegemon for like 19 or 20 years.
It's been a pretty good 19, 20 years.
It's been a great 20 years. But so if we're going into a post-American world, why should that be a surprise? Why should that be, isn't it just a return to normalcy?
At some level, yes. We've lived in a kind of unipolar era for about 20 years. But, really since the end of World War II, we have dominated the world. We have created all the institutions that have shaped the world, because the communist world existed so much in a kind of in its own twilight zone, and in a world that was very quickly seen to be less productive, less advanced. I remember in 1945, at the end of World War II, the United States had 50% of global GDP. Soviet Union had 13%. So it was always a very unequal contest. So I would argue that there's an even broader sense, a big shift, because since 1945, we have really been the dominant power in the world in a way that no country has since the Roman Empire. And that's what's changing. So you're right that in terms of the kind of hyperpower phase since the end of the Cold War, it's only been 20 years. But it's been a longer run in many senses of the word. If you look at the 1950s, the reach of American power, with the rest of the world was flat on its back. Europe was basically flat on, had been destroyed. Japan had been destroyed. That was a pretty different world from the world we're in now. A world in which China is growing at three times the pace of the United States, where Brazil has become this big, important player. We're used to a whole different model. When we would go around the world, it was like the American tourist who'd go around the world and just be stunned at what the dollar would buy and how you could live as a middle-class American would go to Paris and stay at the Ritz and dine at Maxime's. Well, go to Paris today. It's a very different world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when Canadians begin flooding into the U.S. to buy stuff, that we're in trouble. Yes, right over there. Yes, that's right.
What do you think are the ramifications for climate change with the rise of the rest?
Good question.
I think the single most important aspect of this is coal in India and China. That's 80% of the new stuff coming out. And I think we have approached it basically in the wrong way. I know one is supposed to regard the Kyoto Treaty as sort of holy grail because Bush didn't like it. But sometimes George Bush is right. This is a case where, while his manner of doing it was unfortunate and egregious in the usual kind of unilateral way, the basic point that the Bush administration made was that by China and India not being part of the treaty, it really made it kind of meaningless. And let me tell you why. Between 2 years ago and 2012, when Kyoto expires, India and China will build a new coal-fired power plant every week. And that's 850 coal-fired power plants. The combined CO2 emissions of that is five times the total savings of the Kyoto Accords, if implemented, if adhered to. So you can put in all those wonderful light bulbs. I have them in my house. You can drive a Prius as much as you want. India just ate that for breakfast, and China just ate that for lunch. You have got to deal with the problem of Indian and Chinese coal. And the only answer to it, in my opinion, is subsidies for clean coal in India and China. How do you do it? Well, the most efficient way would be a carbon tax, which you then use the proceeds to fund. I understand the technology is experimental, but that's the only thing we have. But it's not going to happen. I mean, if you can find me an American politician who is going to go to the American people and say, I have two pieces of news for you, my friends, as John McCain likes to say, my friends, I'm going to raise your taxes, and then I'm going to take the money and give it to the Chinese and the Indians. I think you will find a very brave American politician. I think the next best solution is a cap and trade system, which actually I think is more broadly agreed to. It would have to be tight. It would have to be real. It would have to be monitored. There are all kinds of provisions. Cap and trade is a very complicated system to get right, but I think that is our best hope. But we need to do it fast. We need to get everyone involved because if we don't do that, 80% of the new stuff that's going to go up in the air is going to be Chinese and Indian coal.
Let's have one last question. I think there was somebody way back there. Let's get to the back.
I wanted to ask you about the recent events in Lebanon and the either impotence or inability of the West to support the government there, and whether that bodes ill for Israel in terms of having a reliable security partner.
Wow. Are you happy that I asked one more question?
Sure. No. It's part of the challenge. Look, I think that what it points to, I generally try not to be in very partisan, but I think this really is a sign of the collapse of the Bush administration's approach to this kind of diplomacy, because it has been a diplomacy that basically has said, there are bad guys out there, we're going to beat them on the head, we're going to isolate them, we're not going to talk to them. When the Israelis beat them on the head, we're going to cheer and tell them it's a great thing they're doing. The problem is that many of these organizations are also political entities. You know, Hezbollah is a political organization that happens to also do terrorism. The reason it has strength is not just that it has rockets, it's that it has the support of 1 million Lebanese Shia. Why does it have that? Because it was founded to oppose the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and it acquired a kind of heroic status from that. It then went on to become the voice of the Shia community in Lebanon, and the Shia are, by the way, institutionally discriminated in Lebanon. They make up 40% of the population. They are by law allowed only 18% of the seats in parliament. So there is a real sense in the Shia community that they are being screwed, frankly. And, you know, you can see their point. They are also incredibly good at providing social services. So now, when you face an entity like that, our solution is, let's give more arms to the Lebanese government. But the Lebanese government in this recent foray stood down. It would not confront Hezbollah because they understand that these guys are politically very powerful and they didn't want to lose face within Lebanon. So what is the solution? The solution is you have to have a political strategy in these countries. You have to be talking to these parties. You have to be figuring out how do you appeal to the Shia community to make them understand that we are not their enemy, that what we want them to do is in their long-term interest. You got to get the other communities in Lebanon to change the very iniquitous rules of power sharing in Lebanon so that these people, their legitimate demands are being agreed to. I would argue this is a very similar issue with Hamas. You know, people say, will you talk to Hamas? Who are you going to make peace with if you're not making peace with Hamas? I mean, this is Golda Meir's famous line. She said, if I'm not going to make peace with my enemies, who am I going to make peace with? I mean, if you want to make peace with Mahmoud Abbas, fine, but he's kind of already there. Mm-hmm. The problem is not Abbas. The problem is the, you know, the 40-50% of the Palestinians who don't support the Abbas view. I think it's even our problem in Afghanistan with the Taliban. The Taliban have a core of support among the Pashtuns in Afghanistan. We have to recognize that, and we have to ask, why do they do this? You know, how much of this is legitimate? How much of this is illegitimate? How much of it can we wean off? How much can we seduce? I mean, the best example of doing this effectively is that great liberal softy, General David Petraeus. Petraeus' strategy in Iraq has basically been to go to the Sunni community, to people who we were calling terrorists 1 month earlier, and to offer them cash. And say, if you will make a deal, if you will lay down your arms, if you will agree to join in the Iraqi project, the national project, here are the terms, you know. There's very tough terms. You can't do any more terrorism. You got to support the government. But if you do that, we will, you know, you will now get carrots, not sticks. seems to have worked pretty well, and the president takes enormous credit for it. I wish he would just talk to General Petraeus about what it feels like to talk to your enemies and talk to people you once called terrorists. And, you know, if that's succeeding, why not recognize what we need is a political strategy in all these parts of the world, because that is the permanent strategy that we can adopt. You can beat these people up on the head, as the Israelis did with Hezbollah. The problem is, they live there. And they're not going away. And tomorrow and the day after that, they pick themselves up. And you're still facing them. That's the part, you know, it's a much more difficult strategy. And it's not as telegenic. And it doesn't make you sound like the macho tough guy. But it's probably the thing that works at the end of the day. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you, Fareed Zakaria. Thank you, Reza Aslan. Both of these gentlemen will be signing their books in the lobby after this program, and thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.